What I find disturbing is that a company which is inextricably linked with biological warfare research, and which also has a German affiliation, and this should not be interpreted as anti-German, because obviously, as I've noted, the core of Third Reich's war-making industry and many of the German core corporations are inextricably linked with many of their American counterparts. Hence, I refer to that as the transatlantic financial and industrial axis that I've focused on for the better part of two decades. What I find disturbing is that we are now, actually a lot of things I find disturbing, but we are now going to vaccinate all of our service personnel, and the entity that is going to be doing that is not only inextricably linked with biological warfare research, it is a German corporation, and one wonders whether perhaps there might be some something else in those vaccines. Not only possible accidental contaminants, but one wonders if perhaps an enemy that wanted to do in the United States and its people, or perhaps stimulate a revolt in the U.S. military, could perhaps vector the U.S. military using this vaccine. The German corporations are controlled at bottom by the altogether remarkable and deadly Bormann Flight Capital Organization that I've spoken about in the past. Literally, the economic component of an underground Reich that grew directly out of the German Flight Capital Program that was investigated as part of Operation Safe Haven by U.S. intelligence during the closing phases of World War II. Turning once again to Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, and discussing the control of the German corporations by the remarkable and altogether deadly Bormann organization, an institution that I believe will prove to be the dominant element in human affairs on this planet. Turning once again to Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, Paul Manning writes, "As for Martin Bormann, this now elderly recluse is ever a keen watcher and manipulator in the silent, gigantic struggles among worldwide industrial and financial powers. Atop an organizational pyramid that dominates the industry of West Germany through banks, voting rights enjoyed by majority shareholders in significant cartels, and the professional input of a relatively young leadership group of lawyers, investment specialists, bankers, and industrialists, he is satisfied that he achieved his aim of helping the fatherland back on its feet. To ensure continuity of purpose and direction, a close watch is maintained on the profit statements and management reports of corporations under its control elsewhere. This leadership group of 20, which is in fact a board of directors, is chaired by Bormann, but power is shifted to the younger men who will carry on the initiative that grew from that historic meeting in Strasbourg on August 10th, 1944. Old Heinrich Müller, by the way, interrupting, formerly the head of the Gestapo, actually, as of 81, still head of the underground Gestapo, old Heinrich Müller, chief of security for the NSDAP in South America, that's the German Nazi Party, is the most feared of all, having the power of life and death over those deemed not to be acting in the best interests of the organization. Some still envision a Fourth Reich. This is but the dream talk of aging adventurers who will soon pass from the mortal scene. What will not pass is the economic influences of the Bormann organization, whose commercial directives are obeyed almost without question by the highest echelons of West German finance and industry." Quote, "All orders come from the shareholders in South America," unquote, I have been told by a spokesman for Martin Bormann. This again was written in 1981. And again, it deals with the altogether remarkable and deadly Bormann organization. Please note that control of German corporations is through the remarkable Bormann organization, an altogether deadly entity that I believe will prove to be the dominant element in human affairs on this planet. And I believe the future will belong to those aging inventors. I do not think their dream I do not think that their talk is, quote, dream talk, as Paul Manning has characterized it. One thing that I'm afraid of is the possibility that the vaccines now being administered, the anthrax vaccine, which will be administered by Merck, might have some contaminants. Again, vaccines can be contaminated. In fact, there are questions about vaccines that may have led to Gulf War syndrome. San Francisco Examiner, Monday, December 22nd of 1997, AP story out of Cleveland, vaccine test on GIs reported. Paper says 8,000 got it in Gulf War. An experimental vaccine with unknown health effects was given to 8,000 unwitting soldiers in the Persian Gulf War despite an Army Review Board's recommendation against doing so, a newspaper has reported. The botulinum toxoid vaccine was meant to protect against chemical and biological warfare, but is now being studied as a possible source of the health problems that have been called Gulf War disease or syndrome. That ruling was overridden after the Department of Defense cited national security concerns, the newspaper said. By the way, veterans of the armed forces provide much of the, donate a lot of the blood that goes into the American blood supply. By the way, that same vaccine may very well be finding its way into Israeli veins as well. San Jose Mercury News, Tuesday, February 3rd of 1998. AP story, Dateline, Jerusalem. Fearing attack, Israel seeks biological weapon antidotes. Skipping down, the Yediot Aharonot and Mariv dailies ran front page photos of a bottled antidote to the deadly anthrax bacteria, a biological agent that UN and U.S. experts believe Iraq may have hidden at sites off-limits to weapons inspectors. And by the way, the article maintains that the Israelis are now looking for vaccines against biological warfare attack. One wonders if perhaps the Underground Reich might score a twofer by contaminating that anthrax vaccine. That comes to mind because of a terrifying book, a book that I think is far more than the novel it purports to be. It's put out, by the way, by National Vanguard Books, which is the Nazi publisher who puts out the Turner Diaries, purportedly the model for Timothy McVeigh. And this book is about a Nazi takeover of the United States in the mid-21st century when the SS infiltrate the U.S. Army. Their underground capital organization buys into the media, and following the wiping out of much of the U.S. population by a biological warfare attack using genetically engineered viruses, the Speaker of the House takes over after the President and Vice President are killed and invites the Nazi element into a ruling coalition. Of course, we know that couldn't happen, don't we? That concludes this segment. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening. Well, you are listening to the KFJC Month of Mayhem Memorial Day Weekend Uncle Sam and the Swastika Special, detailing the collaboration between corporate America and the fascist powers of World War II. What we're going to do next is to play a two-hour interview. Actually, it's slightly less than 2 hours, four segments, each slightly less than a half hour, with John Loftus, a former career military officer and Justice Department investigator with a very high security clearance, as well as power of attorney for a number of former intelligence officers, both American and British, who, under the cloak of anonymity, have disclosed a lot of information to him about some of the things that have taken place during the course of the Cold War. This particular book that was co-authored by John Loftus and Mark Ahrens is called The Secret War Against the Jews, which is an unfortunate title in that I think it's kept a lot of people from reading the book because they go, oh, I don't want to read about Jews. I don't like Jews. What it's really about is about the power politics of the petroleum industry and the intelligence community and international fascism. And listeners will hear some of the same elements that have been discussed in the broadcast so far, only integrated within the context of more recent events, going all the way up through the Persian Gulf War and the Iran-Contra scandal. This first side is about a half hour in length. Those of you who are taping, please get ready to do so. 3, 2, 1, here we go. My name is Dave Emery, and it's my privilege to introduce to this audience John Loftus, a former career military officer and Justice Department investigator, and along with Mark Ahrens, the co-author of a remarkable new book called The Secret War Against the Jews, subtitled How Western Espionage Betrayed the Jewish People. The Secret War Against the Jews was published by the St. Martin's Press in hardcover and copyrighted 1994. John, welcome to our airwaves.
Well, thank you for inviting me, Dave.
Before we actually delve into the substance of your book, John, I think it might be useful for the benefit of the audience to give a little bit of background information about how you came to be investigating the material that you investigated in The Secret War Against the Jews. I know I have been following your professional career since an appearance on 60 Minutes and the publication of your 1982 book, The Ballaris Secret.
Yeah, and well, it started back in 1977 when I started work for the Attorney General of the United States. And under the Carter and then the Reagan administrations, I was part of the Office of Special Investigations, the Nazi War Crimes Unit. And my job was to work with the intelligence agencies to see if I could find any leads where there were Nazis hiding in America. Well, what I found out instead was that many of the Nazis I'd been assigned to prosecute were already on the government payroll. I got permission from the CIA to go public, and I appeared on 60 Minutes in 82 and then wrote my first book about it. I wrote another book about Nazis called Unholy Trinity, involved in the Vatican connection. Well, I had done two books on Nazis, and a lot of people in the intelligence community had sort of come to trust me and speak to me in confidence. And they said, if you think what we did with the Nazis was bad, let us tell you what we did to the Jews. And then I knew I was going to have to pretty much take some time away permanently from my legal practice and finish a very, very long research project. So after some 12 years and more than 500 interviews with former intelligence agents, my co-author and I have put together what we hope is a definitive history of all the covert operations and dirty tricks we pulled on the Jews and on Israel in the 20th century.
It might be interesting, John, to, in a sense, begin with the ending of your book. As we are recording this on June 2nd, 1995, the world's attention has been fixed in recent weeks on the 50th anniversary of VE Day, the end of World War II in Europe. During the course of your investigations with the Office of Special Investigations, you came across an element in the United States called the Vorkommando Moscow. Could you tell us just a little bit about what that unit was?
Sure. It was one of many Nazi intelligence units that operated on the Eastern Front. The Vorkommando Moscow was a unit of the elite SS intelligence that recruited local volunteers from the fascist groups of Eastern Europe, primarily from White Russia, the Ukraine, and the Baltic states. And these people, at the end of World War II, went underground and then were recruited by the British Secret Service. The British said, well, look, you know, the Germans are defeated. Now the Russians are the new enemy, and who better to help us prepare for World War III than these very people from Eastern Europe who recently fought with the Nazis. These people aren't really Nazis. They're just nationalists. They're really freedom fighters. Well, it sounded like a good line, but the only problem with the freedom fighter program was that the guy in charge of it was in Britain with Kim Philby, and Kim Philby was the highest-ranking communist agent inside the British Secret Service. And the people he was sending us weren't freedom fighters. They were actually the dregs of the Nazi war criminals, many of whom could be easily blackmailed into working for the Soviets. It's one of the reasons we suffered so many casualties in the Cold War.
The average American in 1995 would perhaps find the notion that U.S. intelligence would respond with enthusiasm to the British intelligence suggestion that we employ Third Reich collaborators as agents and actual foot soldiers against the former Soviet Union during the Cold War.
But to be fair, U.S. intelligence didn't. The CIA was out hunting Nazis. The Army was out hunting Nazis. President Truman had given strict orders about it. Congress had passed laws. What happened is that a tiny group of officials in our State Department intelligence service committed mutiny. They figured that President Dewey would be in office very soon and Truman would be defeated.
Mm-hmm.
And that behind the president's back and without any authorization, they were helping the British Secret Service relocate these so-called freedom fighters to America.
We're going to be that. I wanted to get into that in more detail after filling in some of the background to the politics of the Dewey-Truman 1948 election. Mm-hmm. But I think for the benefit of the average American in 1995, it might be worth going into some background information about how American society came to be receptive to the importation of elements like the Vorkommando Moscow. Now, certainly there are many Americans, both in government and out, who would be opposed to that kind of thing. I have spent much of my professional career exposing some of the scandals and misdeeds of the intelligence community and the military, but there are certainly many people within both, and these are people who contributed to your book, who would regard something like this with horror. And yet, as we remember the Second World War, as we remember the political forces that brought about that cataclysmic event, one which echoes forward to this day, and again, we have recently passed the 50th anniversary of the observation of the 50th anniversary of D-Day, one of the aspects of the history of World War II that has not survived particularly well, and among the many strong points of your book, I think, is the fact that you delve into this in great detail, and that is the fact that not all Americans were opposed to Hitler. In fact, there were some very significant elements of what an author named Burton Hirsch termed the American elite, or the Wall Street elite, who were doing business with Hitler, and in some cases were openly pro-Nazi and pro-fascist.
Yeah, I think it's fair to say that back in the 20s and 30s, there was a substantial number of American businessmen and investors who thought that Germany was a dandy place to put their money during the Depression. And when the mark was stabilized, they made a fortune. Now, these people weren't, for the most part, fascists. They didn't much like Hitler. They were generally of the old monarchist crowd. And the German businessmen assured them that, you know, Hitler was just a dog on a chain, and they could he'd be useful to keep the communists and the labor unions at bay. Well, Hitler broke the chain, seized power, and as one British investor said, it's very hard to emigrate with a steel mill. Their money was already in Germany. And it's an unfortunate fact that 70% of the money that went to finance the Third Reich came from American and British investors.
70%?
70%.
That is a remarkable figure. Many of these people certainly were simply business opportunists. There were, however, some of the industrialists and financiers who did have pro-Nazi and pro-fascist sympathies.
No doubt about that. Not just the financiers. There was Edward Windsor, the King of England at the time, was an outspoken admirer of Hitler. When I was going through some of the classified archives, I found records where the British had wiretapped Windsor and found that he was, not entirely unsympathetic to the Nazi point of view. And this was confirmed by American interrogations of the Nazi foreign minister, Ribbentrop, after the war. Windsor was pretty much on their side.
I wanted to get into the interesting connections of the British royal family to this milieu a little bit later. There are two names that will ring familiar. In fact, there are a number of names that will ring familiar to students of economics and modern American power politics. One of the names that figures most prominently in your book, before dealing with events before, during, and after World War II, is Alan Dulles and his friend, or his brother, excuse me, John Foster Dulles, a fellow Eisenhower appointee, and also a senior partner in Sullivan and Cromwell. Could you perhaps detail some of the connections between the Dulles brothers, Sullivan and Cromwell, and Third Reich finance and industry?
Certainly. The law firm of Sullivan and Cromwell before World War II was one of the key power centers for the transfer of American investment money into Germany. Sullivan and Cromwell represented most of the major financial houses on Wall Street, companies like Brown Brothers Harriman, for example. A few Americans would realize it, but George Bush's father and grandfather headed up what the U.S. government termed during World War II as Nazi fronts. In fact, their companies were seized after the outbreak of war as outright Nazi fronts, but it didn't quite make the press. Dulles was the lawyer that put together the cloaking mechanisms. And the American investors that put their money in Germany had no qualms about keeping it there during the war. In fact, they operated on both sides of the fence. They made a profit on both sides of World War II.
What was George Bush's ancestor's name, the individuals who were involved with these Nazi fronts?
His namesake was George Herbert Walker.
Right. And, of course, George Bush's full name is George Herbert Walker Bush.
Yeah, and Prescott Bush, George's father, married into Walker's family. He was the son-in-law. And Walker got Prescott seats on all the nice little boards, the Hamburg America Line and the various Union Bank. And, in fact, young George dropped out of Yale because he knew that in a few weeks his dad's companies were about to be seized as Nazi fronts, and George enlisted in the army to save the family's honor.
One of the names that has stood astride American power politics and American finance in the last century or so is, of course, the Rockefeller Company. And the Rockefellers figure prominently in the early part of the book, The Secret War Against the Jews. In fact, one of the things that you discuss is the Rockefellers' secret channeling of oil to the Third Reich, not only before World War II, but during World War II. Could you perhaps detail that for us?
Yes, Standard Oil Company was one of the major partners in several of the German investment schemes in the 20s and the 30s. And the Rockefeller Company saw Germany as a great place to expand their global investments. Germany, at that time, was the only major nation that allowed monopolies, cartels, if you will, and they also had a real dominant position in international patents. So it was a nice way to organize control of various patents, various technologies, and in effect seek domination of a large portion of the world market. For Rockefeller, when the war broke out, when Britain and Germany were fighting, he saw it as an opportunity for the United States to take over Britain's markets in South America, and he proposed that in writing to President Roosevelt. That's one of the factors that led Rockefeller to become one of our intelligence chiefs in Latin America during World War II. Unfortunately, while he was down there, Nelson didn't quite behave himself. In fact, his company actually leased one of their headquarters to the Nazi Party in the area. And the oil companies continued to do business with the Nazis during the war. It got very embarrassing, because particularly with the Saudis, people like Alan Dulles were actually organizing a bit of blackmail against the United States in wartime. There was an actual threat made that if the oil company's ties to Nazi Germany were investigated, that the supply of oil to the U.S. war effort would stop. Then Saudi Arabia, for example, demanded a bribe so that they, in order to, you know, not to sell oil to Hitler anymore. And we actually paid it. They were the only neutral country in the world to receive lend-lease payments during World War II.
And this was to prevent them from shipping oil to the Nazis?
Oh, they already were. They had started it. You know, but and then in fact, even after the promise was made, instead of capping their oil wells, they continued to sell to both sides.
This basically, what the actions of the Rockefellers and Alan Dulles constituted treason, did they not?
Oh, yeah, but the trick was to get the evidence. Now, Roosevelt knew that people like Dulles and Rockefeller were involved in very shady deals because British intelligence had started bugging them, all right? That's why, for example, even though Alan Dulles was the lawyer for most of the Nazi companies in America, he was offered a job with American intelligence. Now, his office in Rockefeller Plaza was one floor above the British intelligence wiretap unit, and they were trying to get the goods on. That's, again, one of the reasons why Alan Dulles was transferred to Switzerland, in the hopes that our codebreakers could keep track of his little shenanigans on behalf of the Germans. Roosevelt had planned to wrap up the whole ball of wax after World War II with a banker's trial at Nuremberg, where the Nazi bankers would then name and indict their American co-conspirators. But after Roosevelt's death, the whole issue was just swept under the rug, and most of them got away with it, except for Nelson Rockefeller.
So that there actually, had Franklin Roosevelt lived and been able to do what he wanted to do, there would have been American industrialists and financiers in the defendant's dock at Nuremberg.
Yeah, absolutely. There was a major unit set up called Operation Safe Haven to track where the Nazi money was going towards the end of the war, because they were moving all their capital out. And there were a large number of American corporations that were tracked. The Chase Manhattan Bank, for example, was known to be receiving the money. But most of the Nazi money went to South America through various corporations, again, headed by Alan Dulles, who had a lot of experience down there, especially in Argentina. And then the money was then laundered back through a front called the World Commerce Corporation for investment in West Germany. And that's how the miracle of the West German recovery began in the 50s.
I'd like to read just a few sentences from The Secret War Against the Jews. In a chapter, specifically chapter 4, called The Mutineers, you and Mr. Ahrens write, "History books tend to omit the fact that the men who carried out the Holocaust largely went unpunished for their war crimes, an example that haunts us today in Bosnia-Herzegovina. Moreover, the vast bulk of the wealth of the Nazi Empire quietly disappeared before the end of World War II, only to reappear within a decade in the hands of the same men who financed Hitler's war against the Jews. Alan Dulles' clients were not defeated, only inconvenienced. This substantial reversal of the Allied victory, our sources say, was engineered by Dulles through his corrupt protégés, James Jesus Angleton, and his fascist father, Hugh Angleton." Before we get to the Angletons, and that's something that I wanted to explore in just a couple of minutes, this, again, to the average listener in 1995, might appear absolutely incredible that many of the people involved with Third Reich finance and industry escaped punishment, and that actually during the World War, during the Second World War, some of the most prominent names in American industry and finance, as well as politics, people like the Rockefellers, people like the Dulleses, were actually engaged, not openly, but they were engaged in business with the Third Reich and committing treason. You talk in this chapter, The Mutineers, about some American and British industrialists who actually sought to undermine the denazification process and to undermine attempts to reverse the political field, so to speak, in Europe. Could you go into that at greater length for us?
Sure. As soon as Roosevelt died, there was a massive effort, particularly inside the U.S. State Department, to undo everything that Roosevelt had tried to do. Morgenthau's plan for the deindustrialization and denazification of Germany was immediately sabotaged.
That was Henry Morgenthau, Secretary of the Treasury?
Yeah.
Right.
And he had some plans, some of which admittedly were over the top, but his general policy was good. General Eisenhower, for example, was firmly committed to denazification. But for some reason, the major German companies were supposed to be broken up into smaller pieces, never quite were. And many of the Nazi industrialists reemerged from the top. People were even pardoned from Nuremberg and resumed control of their companies. Outright war criminals from R.G. Farben were smuggled in the United States to go to work for the W.R. Grace Company.
Otto Ambrose was one of those, and in fact, when Mr. Grace died recently, that was one item that figured in a very small way in his obituary, yeah. When J. Peter Grace died, that is. One of the things that's interesting, too, as we look back from 1995, the German economic miracle, or quote miracle, unquote, might be a better way of putting it, is obviously one of the economic factors that has dominated the second half of the 20th century, at least the last few decades of it. And as you point out, and as you've already mentioned briefly, much of the capital that went to finance the German economic recovery was actually money that had belonged to the Third Reich and in turn was inextricably linked with this transatlantic industrial and financial nexus that we had been talking about.
Yeah, I don't mean to sound like a one-world conspiracy, but there were a significant, small but significant group of international money men that did their very best to ensure that the West German economy revived immediately. And they were had no qualms at all about the Nazis taking power. For give you a classic example. A friend of mine was a prosecutor at Nuremberg in the banking trials, and he was preparing a case against Hermann Ebbs, who had been director of the Deutsche Bank.
Mm-hmm.
But somehow, there never was quite enough money allocated, not enough staff, and a decision was made to terminate the prosecution. The day that the termination decision was made, the British appointed Ebbs as their economic advisor in the British zone of West Germany.
And it was literally business as usual after that point.
Oh, yeah.
One of the things that is sad to my way of thinking is that the term conspiracy theory has been bandied about so much. I think it often serves to neutralize some important political science and an awareness of history. Certainly some of the proto-fascistic and paranoid conspiracy theories that have been...
I think one of the things that this book, The Secret War Against the Jews, does is debunk the great conspiracy theory that the Jews are are all communists and they own all the banks and all the other nonsense that goes along with it. In fact, just from a combination of greed and stupidity, the Jews just ended up being the victims. For example, none of the major Jewish bankers emerged from World War II with their fortunes intact. But if you check the Fortune 500 listings of the world's wealthiest men, you'll find several convicted Nazi war criminals up there.
It is an interesting, in fact, I was going to, in the last part of our discussion, talk about the relevance of some of the anti-Semitic conspiracy theories. But the sad fact is, though, that as debased as the word has become in our contemporary political lexicon, there are conspiracies afoot. And indeed, in studying the history that you and your co-author, and beyond that, the intelligence sources that you drew upon, and I want to get to that later on in our discussion, you make it quite clear that, in fact, much of our history is being governed secretly by some extremely powerful operators.
I wouldn't say governed. I would say influenced.
Influenced, okay.
Yeah, I think...
That'd be a better word.
Maybe before World War II, the major corporate powers could, say, had 40% of influence in the U.S., and now I think that's declined to 5 to 10%. There's been a substantial decrease in the power and influence of multinational corporations in terms of politics in America over the last 50 years. But, and again, it wasn't a type of conspiracy that I would use as a criminal prosecutor in terms of a concerted effort to promote fascism. There really were parallel, coincidental targets of opportunity that people wanted to get rich. And dealing with the Germans before World War II, while not immoral, was certainly not illegal either. And it seemed like a good place to invest money, and once the money was in there, they wanted it back.
One, I think, might argue, and this is not a point I want to linger on, Pat, too much due to the interests of time. One could argue, I think, that fascism itself has as its root a desire to make money, suppressing labor and gaining a totalitarian control over industry and finance.
Oh, yeah, and in polite British circles, it was called corporatism rather than fascism, that society would best be governed by an elite group of corporate leaders who would make the decisions for the masses without the hindrances of democratic oversight.
Mussolini even referred to his fascist system, and he coined the term as the corporate state. John, you brought up the British elite, and one of the things that figures prominently in yours and Mr. Aaron's book is, on the one hand, the role of the intelligence community, both in this country and in Britain and elsewhere. And in particular, there are a series of fascinating, very important, and frankly, Byzantine intelligence machinations that appear to have exerted a profound influence behind the scenes. Earlier, you alluded to a scandal that bedeviled British intelligence and the British royal family during World War II, and prior to World War II. The recent VE Day 50th anniversary observations featured footage of the British royal family presiding over the British observation of that anniversary. And yet, as you've already pointed out, and as I'd like you to detail it a little more, the British royal family was not untainted by the stain of fascism, and this actually proved very vexatious to British intelligence over a period of years.
Oh, yeah, I read J. Edgar Hoover's private communication to the Attorney General saying that Windsor was such a dangerous Nazi that it was not enough to intern him on an island during the war, that he actually should be locked up in a prison. Windsor was the guy who wrote to Hitler that Britain would not interfere with his plans concerning the Jews or anything else. Windsor was the guy who, after he was forced to abdicate, was perfectly willing to sell his country's secrets to the Germans, and did. Churchill was frantic that as American army officers uncovered some of these Nazi records, that they'd be returned to England as fast as possible to spare further embarrassment.
And this actually had proved to be a thorn in the side of British intelligence for many years after the war. In fact, people who, British intelligence operatives who had participated in the cover-up of the Duke of Windsor's fascist connections. And by the way, he was forced to abdicate because, or he decided to abdicate because he wanted to marry a commoner, an American woman named Wallace Simpson.
Well, that was the public reason given. And in fact, the British Secret Service had wiretapped Windsor's phone line and found that he was in pretty near constant communication with the Nazi embassy in Germany before the war, and was making all sorts of political decisions and promises without consulting with Parliament. And so they had to find a polite way of firing the king.
So that his relationship with Wallace Simpson, you're saying, was actually something of a PR excuse,
yeah,
and not really the main element in his
yeah,
abdication.
Yeah.
John, we are nearing the end of our cassette here. What I would like to do is take a break, and then we'll resume the discussion with some analysis of some fascinating intelligence-related scandals that you go into in your book, the Max Network and the Vessel Scam. But I'd like to do that after a break, and that'll give us both a chance to rest up and give me a chance to re-cue our cassette. We have been speaking with John Loftus, along with Mark Ahrens, the authors, of The Secret War Against the Jews, subtitled How Western Espionage Betrayed the Jewish People, published in hardcover by the St. Martin's Press, copyright 1994. We will be back after a break. Broadcasting from Foothill College, this is KFJC Los Altos Hills, and this is KFJC's Month of Mayhem, Uncle Sam and the Swastika Memorial Day Weekend Special. This, of course, is Memorial Day Weekend when we commemorate our dead from foreign wars. And the largest and most costly of our foreign wars was the Second World War, and the real story of that war was the funding of the fascist powers of World War II by major corporations, including and especially American corporations, something that has a profound implication for the present, the connections that are entwined in that particular milieu. My favorite word, are very, very, very much with us today. I would also note that this is now, although this is a tradition that we've been doing for many years now on KFJC, now there are a number of class action lawsuits against many corporations, including American corporations, and none other than Gray Davis, the governor of California, has agreed to participate with the plaintiffs in one of those suits against, among others, Ford and General Motors. So what was old is new again. We're going to go directly to the next half hour side of this interview. This interview was conducted in June of 1995. This is the second of a four-part interview, second part of a four-part interview with John Loftus. This is a half hour in length. Those of you who are taping, please get ready to do so. 3, 2, 1, here we go. Once again, it is my privilege to be joined by John Loftus, the co-author of The Secret War Against the Jews, published in hardcover by the St. Martin's Press in 1994. Mr. Loftus's co-author is Mark Ahrens. The book is subtitled How Western Espionage Betrayed the Jewish People. John, before the break, we were talking about the fascist connections of the Duke of Windsor and the embarrassment that this caused to the British family, and also the problem that presented to British intelligence, both during the war and after World War II. There was a considerable amount of footage shown on the in the electronic media of the British royal family presiding over the 50th anniversary of VE Day, or the British Observations of Same. One of the factors that looms very large in yours and Mr. Ahrens' book is the input of people within the intelligence community, including a group of veteran intelligencers who agreed to participate in yours and Mr. Ahrens' effort on condition of anonymity. You refer to them as the old spies. Could you perhaps just tell us a little bit about them?
These were people principally retired from the U.S. and British intelligence communities, who wanted to tell their story of what really happened, but to do so they had to do it under the condition of legal anonymity and with knowledge that as an attorney client I would keep their names confidential, and that in turn, because of my role in working for the Attorney General, they knew that everything I would write would have to be cleared through CIA publication review. So I was a safe person for them to talk to.
Mm-hmm.
And their general thrust is that intelligence is the most valuable commodity in the world, and that there was an interlocking relationship between the intelligence agencies and certain of the corporate powers, principally the oil companies, that the links that were made with the original investments in Germany after the war led to a desperate attempt by the people in the intelligence community to cover some of their corporate bosses. They were trying, for example, to assassinate Hitler and put together an alliance between Germany and England against Russia. That failed to come off when the bomb attempt against Hitler failed to take place. And then after the war, their principal concern was to get their money out without anyone finding out in America or England that these were the people that had helped finance the German war machine in the first place.
The old spies have made an invaluable contribution, and perhaps at the risk of seeming a little corny, at the end, I'd like to pay tribute, at the end of our interview, I'd like to pay tribute to them. John, you mentioned, and perhaps this is a point we've already covered in sufficient depth, but you mentioned that the fascist connections of the Duke of Windsor and his fascist sympathies mm-hmm. actually was of considerable embarrassment to British intelligence and actually affected British intelligence for many years after World War II.
Yeah. British intelligence ran around trying to cover up not just Windsor's Nazi connection, but several, unfortunately, prominent right-wing people in Britain had also been involved with some of the Nazi deals and shenanigans. Now, the people in British intelligence who ran the cover-up were, unfortunately, largely communist agents. People today may not recall the name of Kim Philby and some of his cohorts, like the Hunts and the rest, but they were the people who were entrusted with the job of burying this most awful scandal, that they actually had members of the royal family who were on the wrong side of World War II, not to mention a bunch of British businessmen who would have to be in the dock if Windsor ever went on trial. So those communist agents who, inside Britain, who posed as right-wing neo-fascists, had the perfect cover. And even after their treason was discovered, they could not be prosecuted because of what they knew about the cover-up of the royal family and the British investors. By and large, they were given immunity or simply allowed to escape to Russia.
The world of what Mad Magazine used to refer to as spy versus spy is a very Byzantine and tortuous one. It's one that I generally try to stay away from in my broadcast simply because it is such a complex situation. And as your book makes quite clear, frequently major intelligence agencies themselves are deceived not only by their enemies, but sometimes by their alleged friends.
Oh, my favorite example of that, and we discuss it in the book, is Hitler's secret spy network against Russia, codenamed Max. It was the top secret. They actually had a network of white Russian anti-communists and fascist Jews who every day were delivering to Hitler's generals the top secret mobilization plans of the Red Army. Incredibly detailed reports on every move that Stalin was making. So this network, the Max network, even though they were Jews, was protected by the top general staff of the Third Reich. Even after Hitler ordered all the Jews be fired from jobs, these guys stayed on. And what they didn't know, though, was that all through the war, the Max network weren't fascist Jews. They were communist Jews. They were working for the Russian allies. And the information they were giving Hitler's generals was 99% accurate, except for the occasional day when they went silent. And those are the days we had things like the Battle of Kursk or the Battle of Stalingrad, where the German army suffered their largest defeats. It's probably not hyperbole to say that this intelligence unit, the Max network, was responsible for the Allied victory on the Eastern Front. They literally helped destroy 70% of the Nazi divisions. It was one of the most incredible con games ever perpetrated. And right to the end of the war, the German generals had no idea that they had been taken in so successfully.
Perhaps this would be a case of what Winston Churchill referred to in connection with the RAF and the Battle of Britain, of never have so many owed so much to so few.
Oh, absolutely. It's this small group of Jews actually turned the tide of war in Eastern Europe.
To many of the anti-Semites and fascists that figure in your book, that must have, when it became public after many years, that must have served as confirmation of the anti-Semitic conspiracy theories of which they were so fond. John, you...
Well, unfortunately, though, that doesn't fly because these Jews were neither fascist Jews nor communist Jews. They were Zionists.
Oh, absolutely.
And they were pro-American.
Yeah.
The first thing we did when the war was over was to blow the whistle on the deal.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, guys like Alan Dulles by then had wormed their way back into U.S. intelligence. And they didn't believe it or didn't want to believe it. Believe it or not, Alan Dulles actually hired the remnants of the Max network for the CIA during their Cold War operations against Russia.
Sure, sure.
So you can imagine what a hideous embarrassment that was for the agency.
Absolutely. I was not indicating that they were, in fact, Zionist conspirators, but I can picture some of these fascists upon learning of that and saying, you know, you see, we told you, you can't trust the Jews. They're everywhere, and they lurk behind every bush, and there's a pun there. One of the intelligence scams that you get into in your book, and one which, like so many of the others, had ramifications for literally decades, stretching right on up into George Bush's tenure as Director of Central Intelligence,
mm-hmm.
and that is the Vessel scandal, a truly Byzantine intelligence, counterintelligence machination, which I found reading it. I'm a pretty good reader, and I'm a veteran of this type of research, but I had to make diagrams to follow the players.
It was really cute. I'll try and simplify it. What happened is, a group of American fascists headed by Hugh Angleton, the father of Jim Angleton, volunteered for intelligence service in Rome after World War II because they were working, unfortunately, with the Vatican to rescue a lot of the Nazi money that was coming out. And in order to con President Roosevelt and later President Truman into adopting, to changing their policies, Angleton actually forged Vatican cables. They were codenamed Vessel. And they were delivered right to the President of the United States. And this supposedly was the most secret intelligence from inside the Vatican.
Now, this was James Jesus Angleton.
Right.
And his father, Hugh, was a fascist sympathizer who was working with National Cash Register.
Oh, yeah, that was before the war.
Right, before the war.
Yeah. And then during the war, he was setting up an intelligence network. We still can't tell which side it was on, But after the war, Hugh Angleton was in Rome trying to rescue the remnants of the business investors of the Third Reich, and largely succeeded.